Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your head.
Laura Berger, Gwen Tabaldio with us. They are the authors of Falling in Love Again Every Day, Three Steps to True Connection for Any Couple. As a matter of fact, Laura's an executive coach and a women's leadership expert. Glenn is a CPA, a PMP. He's a project and change management consultant. They've appeared regularly on radio, spreading their right, read, and relate message. Their company is Berdio Group, LLC, and Lauren Glenn are married, and they live in Fort Lauderdale. And let's say, guys, welcome to the show.
Absolute pleasure to be here. How are you?
Oh, I am good. Thank you both for being here. You know, there's the biggest problem that we have today, and I think it's even getting worse. The divorce rate is about 50-55%, and it is growing. Second year, I think, is even worse than that. When the two of you got together, you know, you fell in love, you put it together. When did you realize that there were things in a marriage that you weren't even aware of that pop up and people have to address?
That's funny you should ask. It's a very distinct point in time. And we decided in 2006 that we were kind of gagging on our professions and we had had too much of a good thing. We were way too motivated. We needed a break. And we went off to the jungles of Costa Rica to live for a while. And the nearest traffic light was about an hour and a half away. And we were at the top of this hill. And, you know, things were great. The nature was awesome. But in such a change like that and with less infrastructure than we were used to and in a home that kind of didn't work the way we wanted to, being up on that hill alone together and being in such an abrupt change really peeled back layers of us that we didn't realize existed. We still loved each other. Excuse me, we still respected each other, but it was a lot at once. And so,
you know, it's an interesting point. When you don't have the pressure of the profession, you don't have the pressure of driving back and forth to work every day, you don't have the pressure of the financial pressure of keeping it all together, the cultural pressures, the news, the media, the rest of it. It's very interesting to see what happens when none of it's there, and the only thing in the world is the two of you looking at each other.
Absolutely, Michael. You use the word pressure. I use the word distraction. So when you take all of those distractions away and it's just the two of you, you start to learn things about one another that was, you know, being occupied by distractions.
No, absolutely. Laura, I think the biggest problem that we have as regards to relationships is this. You and I meet, and I'm not going to show you who I am. I'm going to show you who I think you would like me to be. Now I've got this mask on. Then we get together, and I get more comfortable, and as I get comfortable, I become Michael. And 6-8 months later, this is not the guy that you met, and you say to me, you're changing. But down deep, I haven't changed. I'm finally coming out. And when you guys are alone, what I'm hearing is the real yous come out.
Absolutely. And, you know, come from a guy's perspective, when guys end up upsetting their spouses or their significant others, when we have a problem, you know, we tend to withdraw and try to go fix it. And the female will chase, will want to talk. We like to be analytical. We like to plan out our response to things. And that's how these types of communications things, and the problems, they kind of spread like wildfire. You have a little problem at first, and then you want to go fix it, and then, you know, she comes and asks, I want to talk through it, I'm not ready yet. She gets angry, and it just becomes a perpetuating thing. And so you need a way to sit down safely and be heard in full and kind of break that cycle.
Laura, when you're in that position with the two of you all alone, basically alone, and was he the same guy that you came there with? Did you find another Glenn?
Yes, I did. So before we went to Costa Rica, you know, we were very much going down an independent career path, and I prided myself in being this independent woman. And when we moved to Costa Rica, Glenn had really stepped up to the plate in terms of navigating the country and speaking the language, and there was a dependency there that I had on him that I hadn't had before, and he was kind of leading me too. So he took the reins and he was taking the lead, and I was looking at him going, wow, I've never really seen him do that, because I was always doing it myself and not allowing him to really come in and assist. So that was new for him and new for me to experience. So it was somewhat of a role reversal a little bit.
Yeah, but the word that would come up would be, quote unquote, survival. And that's what he did. He jumped in and he did everything that you would possibly want to do to be able to survive in that circumstance. You could have gone to any given city in the country and the same thing would have happened. When I say would have happened, if you have to survive, what's innate within you is going to come out when you need it to come out. Before you guys went, it didn't have to come out in him.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's absolutely right. And when we were there, there were other things that I excelled at that kind of complemented the culture much more than we ever anticipated. So I think that, and I'm speaking for Laura, it wasn't in her rhythm to work within the culture. The culture is very passive. Everything's about diplomacy. There are no outbursts. If something's not going the way you want it to go, which often they didn't, and we were used to getting things when we wanted them in a modern culture. So, for example, we didn't have a phone. We tried to get a phone for 7 months. We never had a phone. And so Laura was looking at my reactions. She wanted me to jump in and be aggressive, but being a person who, for example, is passive, she couldn't understand until kind of we came back why I was reacting the ways I was reacting. She thought I was just rolling over on things, and that even made it worse between us because she had never seen me functioning in that manner.
No, by the way, I think a great example of that is try living in Fairbanks, Alaska for a while. When I first went up there, I was brought up in Los Angeles, fast-paced business, yada, yada. And if you get out of the city and you talk to somebody living away from the city, it's like, how's it going? Dead silence for 2 minutes. Fine. So it's learning a completely different language. And you're right. It is the culture. If you don't tie into the culture, you're going to have a lot of problems there. But what caused you to pick Costa Rica?
So I think I'll take that one again because it was more on my side of the relationship at that time than anything else. There was something about the place, and I see it in people's eyes. And when we were there, I saw it in people's eyes. There's a smile at cash registers. There's a smile in restaurants. Everybody waves when you drive around. The nature is lush. It almost feels like a natural Disneyland of places. And it was laid back. It was friendly. It just felt like a place where, personally, my spirit needed to sit at the time because, as I said, I was kind of gagging on my profession. I was working like crazy, and it just felt like I was sitting in a nice, frumpy chair.
No, by the way, that sounds like America in the 1950s. Serious.
But, I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, but we've changed. You know, I think what we're really dealing with and what I'm hearing you guys, and stop me if I'm wrong because I didn't experience it the way you did, but it's something called acceptance and identity. And we're missing that here because it's so rush. Everybody's moving, going, and doing. But when you go to a place like that, when it slows down and they're smiling because they're accepted and they have an identity of being who they are in that place at the moment. And it's a culture. And I wish we could have more of that here today.
It is acceptance and identity. And I think here in the United States, our identity is what we do. And it was very much the case that I experienced that. So when we moved to Costa Rica, nobody cared what I did. They didn't care about me rattling off, I was the blah, 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 or, you know, they didn't care because it was about who I am as a person. So identity was a real struggle because I was always associating myself with that.
No, absolutely. Great example. I remember when I was a kid, if you had a cool car, you were somebody. But if you didn't have the car, all of a sudden you weren't anybody anymore. And I think it's one of the biggest problems that we have in this particular culture. And I would venture to guess if people were reading the book, they began to see themselves within it, the problems that they had within it, and realize that what they were missing. And you could take that what you're missing and create it for yourself even in today's world. You guys came back, and yet it's the same. You can bring that or create that anywhere you go, but you got to know it's there.
Sure, and as a guy, you can imagine that when we still are, even though society is changing, old habits die hard. We get our validation in the home is through contributing, through work, through success, through. And I'm not saying that Laura didn't; she definitely did. But for a guy, I think it's definitely innate in you. And being in a place where that was all stripped out, then you're looking at your wife and you're saying, "What do I have to contribute now? I mean, you can do the emotional stuff. We can talk up here and whatnot, but I can't, you know, excel and bring anything, and you can't admire me." So we use a technique called Right Re-Relate to get through those issues because we were trying to cope with all those changes and getting to know the new people that we were with.
What you just said, the new people you were with, and isn't it interesting that they're not new people? They're the base of what people are and started out to be, and we learned to be different.
Yep.
We became the new people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, now, in a relationship, the communication, the ability to connect with each other, what was one of the main things that you learned?
So we, as I mentioned, we use this technique called Write, Read, Relate. And we can go into all the benefits of it and why it's so great, but essentially what it does is it breaks these bad habits we haven't communicated, interrupting each other. Let me give you an example of just one sentence that in a relationship would be very difficult to say if somebody was really upset. Yesterday you offended me, but now I forget very much, but now I forgive you. If we're hot, you're not going to get past the yesterday you offended me. So what we did was every single day, instead of getting into these fights about the same things over and over again, we grabbed notebooks, we chose a question, we wrote about it, we committed to writing for 10 minutes in silence about it. We exchanged notebooks, we read about it, and then we discussed it for 10 minutes. And that really avoided the interruption and the fighting. Broke the cycle.
Yeah, but how about adding a little twist to that, okay? How about thinking that yesterday when I offended myself through you, I think that's one of the biggest problems that we have in communication. You said it earlier, you know, the blame, we point a finger, we do whatever there is to do. But when we get to realize it's all us. We recognize something in the way somebody looks, the way somebody said something, the way they're acting at the time, which usually has nothing to do with what they're meaning, but it's the way you take it. You know, talking isn't communication in any way, shape, or form. It's the response of the person on the other side that you're getting. And I think one of the most important things to get is that other person doesn't do anything. You do it yourself when you've recognized something you like or you dislike. And 9 out of 10 times, you never really get down to the core unless you realize that. It's called being responsible for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also think when you're speaking to one another, you're evaluating facial expressions or just body movement and even voice, tone of voice or breathing, how the other person is breathing. And you are processing that and making all of these assumptions. So you're not really even listening to what the other person is saying because you're evaluating that on the spot.
No question about it. And that evaluation doesn't have to be right now. That evaluation can be something that happened 10, 15 years ago from somebody else.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, I had a funny you should say that because I had this luxury when we were in our past lives of sitting in traffic, lots and lots of traffic. And if Laura said something to me that I detected there's something there before she hung up the phone, I would think through it and think through it and think through it, and I'd be in traffic and I have nothing to do but think through it. And by the time I walked through the door, I was already hanging on my cross, or dragging it behind me. And it was just bad news. I mean, it was nothing, but it turns into something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I really believe, you know, I'm thinking of something that I've never thought of before as I'm listening to you talk. I guess it's called, if you want to be with me, if you're going to talk to somebody on the opposite end of that, if you want to be with me, you've got to be more of yourself. And I really believe that's what it is. There's these masks, these facades that we put up, and we're waiting to be insulted. We're waiting for the argument to happen. We're waiting to prove ourselves right about ourselves, that we're not worth it, and whoever it is shouldn't be with us. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that we run into today. It's just be who you are, and it's okay. If we could all have permission to be who we were, I think the world would be completely different.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the real benefits of journaling to one another rather than speaking, because you have the ability, if you're using a laptop of a backspace key, you have the ability to cross out, to say, you know, if your foot's in your mouth, you can take it out without her seeing. And
sure.
So we can actually be ourselves on paper and present our thoughts in a way that won't get us into trouble, because lots of times, you know, we have the experience of communication, we're just not that good at it.
No.
And we can go back and we can retool.
We're starting to run out of time, but let me ask you this question. Is it that we're not good at it or we don't know how to do it? That's why I think.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love with you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And clear tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
In a trance, you fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you too.
Nicholas Lohr with us. He's the author of The Pathfinder, How to Choose or Change Your Career for a Lifetime of Satisfaction and Something Called Success. Nicholas is the originator of the field of career coaching, founder of the Rockport Institute, an organization that has guided thousands of professionals, executive high-tech people, artists, support staff, and government officials through career change and helped numerous people design their work. He's been commended for excellence by two U.S. presidents. And let us say, Nicholas, hi. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi there. Great to speak with you. And hello, everybody out there in Radio Land. It's an honor to get to speak with you. I wish it could be a two-way conversation, but we'll do the best we can.
Okay, no problem. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. Okay,
and
Nicholas, in this...
Folks, I'm just getting over the terrible cold that so many have. So I'm, you know, you're lucky to be listening over the radio waves. Otherwise, you might be catching it. So
if I start sneezing, then we'll know that it wasn't
from
okay.
Me. It's those digital germs that did it.
I hear you. Now, by the way, career change today and satisfaction in career change. Nicholas, with what's going on today, the economy, you know, just is going right to the bottom, and all of the fear that has been created through this country based on what we hear in the media, and everything's terrible. How does somebody actually go about getting a job today? Because it's not a career, something new. It's not what it used to be. It used to be that you'd walk into a place and maybe you had three or four people that you'd be up against as far as being competitive to get that particular position. Today, you got thousands for that same position, so you got to be able to stand out. What's that magic to allow you to stand out?
Well, really, the first thing is to know exactly where you're headed and what you're doing, and to be really certain about that. You know, neuroscience has done all this research over the last 10 to 15 years that we've learned a lot about the brain. And one of those things is being certain about where you're going and what you're up to is really powerful. So it is difficult, but it is difficult to make a career change at any time. I think the biggest difference is that when the economic times are better, that we're not in quite as much a state of fear as we are now. And so the fear affects what we do. And but then the investment experts, you know, the richest man in the world, says we do it backwards. When everybody is afraid and the stocks go down, they say that's the time to buy. And when everybody's confident and feeling flush and they're up, that's, you know, the time to sell. Of course, people don't do that. And that's not the way people behave in terms of their career. So what we do is react to what's happening out in society, and that robs us of having a life we love, because we spend so much time at work. If you really don't like what you're doing, it's going to affect you and all the rest of your life as well.
Nicholas, I learned something probably 50 years ago now. I was working at a particular place. I was spending, 19 years old, and I'm standing there 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, and there were these wheels that would come up on these pallets, and I'd pick a wheel up off the pallet, and I'd put it on the conveyor belt, and the conveyor belt would take it somewhere. There were car wheels. And so I was in shape in those days, but I walked into the personnel office, and I said, I would like to get a job during the day. I was on mids of 5 to midnight, something like that. And I said, I have no life. I cannot, you know, and they laughed at me after they get up off the ground. It was union in those days. But I walked over to the door. I had my hand on the knob, and I turned around, and I looked at the guy, and it's just off the top of my head. And I said, you know, I got a half a brain, and if you let me use it, I can benefit this place. And the guy looked at me, and he said, you know, come back tomorrow. One thing led to the other, and I did a little research with the other people, and I found out there was an opening in the chem lab, and they wanted a chemical analyst. Now, did I have any experience? No, I had high school chemistry, got a D, I think. But one thing led to the other, and I actually got the job. And I think one of the things that we should look at today, in if you're going to go out into that field out there, to open up enough to think that there might be something that you hadn't even thought of that they can see in you that would benefit both of you, and they may put you in a position, those people that are interviewing you, that you never thought of, and they saw the perfect person, and it wasn't even the kind of guy they wanted to hire in the first place.
Yes, that's exactly right. And, well, you know, what you're talking about is going out and interviewing for jobs and being open. And I think that the best thing that you can do long-term, and I'm not talking about going out next week and interviewing for a job, but looking at your life long-term and looking at how important it is to you to have a really high level of quality and self-expression and to be able to wake up in the morning at least some of the time, hopefully most of the time, and to not dread going to work. So that, you know, that takes a different approach from going out and interviewing for a bunch of jobs. What that really takes is saying, first of all, you know, it's making a commitment to doing something that you care about. And so then you make a project, just like you do if you're going to go on vacation or buy a new car or even going to the movies is, in a way, a project, a very little project.
Sure.
But, you know, you don't get to the movies if you aren't committed to getting to go to a movie that night, unless you just wander in. So that commitment to have a life that isn't one of suffering, I think, is the first step. And the job hunting is kind of the last step. And there are a bunch of things in between there that are important. And there are a number of ways you can, you know, once you know what you're going to do, you can market yourself in creative ways to land a job, you know, that may seem absolutely outrageous and you know, beyond anything that's possible. I mean, but career, making a choice about what you're going to do really is harder than it is to land the job. Now,
that's
a lot of people
Nick,
would dispute, yeah.
I was going to say, but that's why there are people like yourself out there. If I had a legal problem, I would not go to court by myself. I would bring the professional expertise in with me to make sure I was on a level playing field. And in today's world, you know, the things that you talk about, they're not innate. It's nothing that's taught in high school or even college in many cases, that, you know, that practical application of the process, the strategy to put into place to go out and really get what you want. Most people don't know how to do that. And thank goodness there's people like yourself around that can, quote unquote, symbolically hold me by the hand and take me through that process to get me where I need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so what the kind of clients that we have, I founded Rockport Institute 31 years ago, and we have had more than 14,000 private clients who have gone through a whole career change process, and also plenty of young people who are picking for the first time. The majority, though, are mid-career people, and they come to us really not knowing what they want to do. All they're really sure of is they don't want to keep doing whatever they were doing in the past, and they want to do something that's a really good fit. So the way we dig into it with them is by doing some really in-depth assessment of natural talents, and, you know, so those are, and many other ways of which you can be a kind of a career detective, where what you can do is look and see what are the best clues about the fit between you and the working world. Because if you go out there and get a job, even if you're fortunate enough to have somebody magically kind of discover you in a job interview, it doesn't mean it's going to fit. So it makes sense to, a little bit like the old noir detective movies, where you've got your little notebook, of course these days it would be a computer, and you look at clues. So I, many years ago, looked at what I was naturally good at doing. I asked my friends what they thought I was good at doing and what kinds, for some clues about my personality. I looked about what the kinds of things I cared about, what mattered to me, the kind of environment that fit, and I looked at what was most important to me. And for example, one of those things was, I knew it was really important for me to get positive feedback. I'm not somebody who deals that well with criticism, so I could probably go and have years of therapy and maybe cure that, but it was, yeah. I realized it was much easier to just have a job where I wouldn't be criticized. So then a detective works to solve the crime, and what you would be doing is taking these clues about how you think and behave and so forth and trying to get some of them over into a new column, which is definite components or specifications of what I'm going to be doing. So then once you have a bunch of them, then you can start looking and seeing what fits. So that's just, you know, kind of a logical process from sure. saying, I'm not going to put up with having a mediocre fit and suffering at work, through designing step by step what you're going to do. And that is the whole point of the book, The Pathfinder, is it's a guide to guide people through doing that in their lives.
Okay, so in essence, what we're really looking at, I'm going to go back and use the word process again, because in today's world, especially in today's world, looking for a job is not the way it was 10 years ago. And, you know, based on culture, based on the economy and even the political bent today, there are so many things involved in going out and getting a job based on that place that you want to go to work for. So it's also knowing that. And I found over
exactly.
the years. Yeah. And I found over the years also that a job interview, it's a two way street. You've got to be.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be interviewing that employer, too. And you said it. If you're not going to be happy where you are, walk out.
And if you're really not sure where you're going, the interviewer will know it. You know, we all can read other people pretty well, whether we know it or not. We kind of know often when somebody's lying to us. And many interviewers are pretty savvy, and they know who are the people who are serious about this job and who really want it and know that this would be a good fit for them. But the whole, you know, getting a job, it's interesting. There are ways to do it that work much better than just going around and hitting interviews.
Sure.
So if you like, I can kind of give you this very radical secret of job hunting that not many people use, but usually works. And if you think about it, it's really very practical.
By the way, absolutely yes, and I hope I never have to use it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I hope you don't either, and I hope I know I won't. I'm never going to have a job.
I haven't worked for anybody in years.
Never going to have a job.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Please go ahead, Michael.
No, I said no. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, it's okay. So here's that job hunting secret. Most people, you know, when you interview for a job and you find out that they pick somebody that the boss knows or somebody that works for the company, that happens a lot. I've heard that story hundreds and hundreds of times. And it's true. That is what happens. Decision makers do not want to depend on human resources to provide them with candidates, and they really don't want to look at all these online sources for resumes. Hiring is personal if you have a choice. So the decision maker would always rather hire somebody that they know, and if they don't, they'll ask people close to them. So what, and that is why networking works. That's what it is about networking that gets you a job. It's the, you know, that's why the old boy network works. You, some old school chum will speak for you, and then, you know, that's the, you know, somebody who works with the decision maker. So what if you don't need a job right now, but this is something that you have some time, you have some months to work on, you don't want to stay at your old job and you want to move, that the very best thing you can do is to find ways to get to know decision makers, whatever it takes. Go to conferences. Go to find out what they do for a hobby. You know, you have to become a little bit of a spy there, too, you know, and learn about these people and get to meet some people who are the decision makers in the company and in the field you want to get into. And then when jobs open up, they'll hire you. But the chances are that the jobs that already exist are going to be filled either from within or from people that the decision maker already knows. So that seems like it's taking, you know, a long step around the barn to get there, but it works. And if you ask a bunch of decision makers how they would most like to hire, almost all of them will tell you they want to hire somebody they know. It doesn't necessarily have to be the very best person, but it's going to be somebody who will be good and they're going to fit in, and, you know, they're not going to go up there on the 13th floor and blow everybody away with an Uzi. They're going to work out well in the company. So that's a job hunting strategy that when we tell people about it, they think it's kind of nutty, but we've seen it work again and again.
Nicholas, you got to do your research. There's no question about that. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at? Where can we get the book and find out more?
Sure. It's Rockport Institute, R-O-C-K-P-O-R-T, like the shoes, rockportinstitute.com. And the book is called The Pathfinder, How to Choose or Change Your Career for a Lifetime of Satisfaction and Success. And it is available in most bookstores in the English-speaking world and on Amazon and everywhere else.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and especially in today's world, in this market, this marketplace we're looking at, what you have is going to help a lot of people. And I hope everybody goes to your website. Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me as a guest. Bye, everybody.
Okay. Take care. Good night. I hope your cold is better.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see?
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Carolyn Reisling with us, full-time middle school teacher, English teacher, and the author of Cyberwink, One Woman's Inside Scoop on Maneuvering the Web's Meat Market, M-E-E-T. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's so nice to be with you all tonight.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's start it out this way. But you said you were 32 years old and you wore a size 2.
Well, I'm not quite 32, and I'm not quite a size 2, but you're close.
Okay, but wait. But that's what happened on the dating service. I think there's
of
so
course.
Many.
Of course, yeah. There's definitely things that people lie about online.
Yeah,
I don't know if you're interested in hearing about that right away. It might scare off your listeners.
No. I mean, go ahead, talk. nobody gets scared. By the way, but with the online dating, obviously, I think for some people it's the most wonderful thing in the world. If you're in a little town and there's only so many people that you can meet, or you're a certain age and nobody's your age that's single, it's a great way to expand and meet somebody. I'm sure there's been some wonderful stories. But at the other side of it, I bet there's been some horror stories.
Yeah, and I've experienced a little bit of both sides of that. So I definitely could tell both stories.
What got you into it in the first place?
Well, what happened was throughout my 20s, I met people the natural way through college or, you know, just in my circle of friends. And I also did full-time volunteer work, so I traveled a lot, and I didn't really want to settle down when I was younger. So suddenly I was over 30, and everybody was kind of married off, and I just, you know, I'm in a, you know, female-dominated profession. And so it wasn't like I was meeting a lot of men at work, you know, and I just, you know, I hadn't really considered it, but then one day my mom actually handed me an article. Now, my mom's in Canada, and I'm in Texas, and she handed me an article, and the article was talking about online dating, and that kind of shocked me because my mom's very much a stranger danger kind of lady, very cautious. And so when she handed it to me and said, you might want to give this a try, I kind of just, you know, that's kind of what got me in.
Okay, so you got in, and I'm sure you walked in very innocently, and you did everything you did. What was it like that those first couple of connections that you made? Were they for real? Did they tell you the truth? Or was it something that they wanted you to think that they were, and if you ever met, quote unquote, that's not who they are?
Yeah, the first couple were actually really pretty positive experiences. Otherwise, I probably would have given up right away. You know, because I was kind of skeptical going in to start with. And I went on a couple of really nice dates, and there might not have been that chemistry or that lasting connection, but they hadn't misrepresented themselves. And there are a lot of lies that people do tell online. And, you know, and I've run into people that, you know, they say that they're 6 foot, you know, a 6 foot tall man, and you know, every man that says he's 5'9" is more like 5'6", and you know how much they make in a year, and you sure. know that kind of thing, and pictures, and the picture's 10 years old. I'm sure you've heard that story before too, right? And,
oh, absolutely. So, no, I've seen some interesting things because, you know, I've been there and done that. And mm-hmm. what I would see, which would, you get a picture of somebody who's really good looking and attractive and whatever, and then there'd be four pictures, you know, that you'd see. And then you get, they were good looking, but when you took a look at the last picture, you began to realize those first three pictures were 15 years old, you know, and the person who you're really talking to is that last picture.
Right, and you would be waiting for her younger sister to show up to meet you, right?
Absolutely.
Instead of her, because, yeah, that's a problem. I have, on my own personal profile, I put about 20 pictures up, and I try to make it so that they're not more than a year old, and so yeah. people kind of get, and I try not to make them all like a headshot or where it looks real glamorous. You know, some of them I'm, you know, on a trip somewhere, and, you know, my hair's not perfectly done or anything, and it's, you know, the one thing that people need to remember is this picture is your first impression. You know,
sure.
it's you need to make sure that, you know, there's a couple of things my guy friends have actually complained about, and it's in the book about different tips that, you know, how women could better represent themselves, but it applies to men as well, is don't wear in every picture, don't wear shades or sunglasses. Because it looks like you're in the witness protection program, or that you know, there's something. Do you have a lazy eye? Are you hiding from the law? Or, you know, don't want your wife or girlfriend to figure out that's you. So, you know, there's things like that, and even people, beware of the people that don't put a picture up too, Michael. That can be a scary situation, because there's probably a reason that they don't want to be recognized.
Oh, sure, so, and you know what I saw a lot of was. In a profile. I want somebody who makes me laugh. Travel, travel, travel. I love to travel. I love to laugh. Well, wonderful. What are you going to do with the rest of your life after you've spent 5 minutes doing that?
No, it's true. And some of the things that people have said is they make these comments like, I'm looking for an honest guy. Well, you know what? They're not going to tell you if they're going to lie to you, and they're not going to tell you if they're going to deceive you. You know, it's kind of a trait thing. And yeah, the whole, I want someone funny, you know,
yeah.
Well, you know, what's funny to you might not be funny to someone else. Right.
No, absolutely. So, how did you find your way through? Did you filter through? Did you end up with somebody?
Well, I've had a couple of very serious boyfriends that I met online, one that almost went toward marriage. And in my book, my book almost reads like a fiction novel, but it has a lot of little stories in it. And so, you know, it talks about the real serious relationship where the man was one step away from asking my dad if he could marry me. So it was very serious. And so I have maneuvered through some relationships locally and long distance through online dating, and I've had some good experience. But for me, you know, as far as I'm looking for a very serious relationship, I'm not looking for something casual. And so, you know, there's only really one person that will be able to eventually fit that bill, you know. So at this point, I'm kind of back to just, you know, where I was a little while ago. I had a boyfriend last fall, and then we kind of decided to end the relationship. And so I'm just now back on the market. So if there's anybody out there that, you know, really nice guy, has a job, is breathing, check out my website.
Wait, she just fell off her chair. She's on the market. She's ready. No, but I think it's really good when you think about it. Look at the opportunity that this affords for people who don't know where to go, that don't like, quote unquote, the bar scene or whatever the case may be.
Sure.
So it's a good thing. Now, let's say, for instance, you and I meet over the internet, and you're young enough to be my daughter, so I'm going to tell you I'm 20 years old. But you and I meet on the internet. Okay. How do you open it up? How do you meet somebody? How do you get to a point where you can really experience what they're like?
Well, what usually happens, at least this is my MO, like my mode of operation, is I usually let the guy make the first move unless I see this amazing profile, and I might wink at them. But usually the guy will, it's called winking, and they send you like a little thing to say, I'm interested. And then I might wink back at them, and then I let them write me the first email. And then you email back and forth. If it's a local person, of course, you know, this is just common sense that you're only going to meet in high traffic public places like a restaurant or a coffee shop, and you're going to drive yourself there. And I can't stress that enough, because I could tell you a horror story about when I got in a car with someone after dinner and I really shouldn't have, you know. And I did get out of it safely, thank goodness, but it was kind of touch and go there. And so you need to be safe. And if it's someone that's coming from far away to meet you for the first time, really make them come to you. If you're the woman, have them go to your city, because that's where you have people that kind of look out for you, your support system's there. And in my book, I give a lot of tips about that and about how to be careful and how to kind of go through the relationship situation. Like, what steps do you do? Like, and it depends. Some people, they're going to call a lot quicker than other people. It just depends. But you need to make sure that you don't quickly give out your phone number before you have at least a sense that this person's okay, because that can also be tough.
Yeah. There's an interesting point when you say getting into someone's car when you really shouldn't have done it. There's also a danger here, too. You know, we live in a very violent, volatile world out there. And that doesn't mean that everybody that you talk to is going to fall into that category. But maybe there's that one, and you're right. There's got to be some safety tips. There's got to be some safety nets to protect you, because when it comes down to it, if you're out there alone with somebody and you're female, with all due respect, everybody's equal. It don't work that way, because you're not strong enough to really get out of the situation. So there's that also.
Yeah, and I would tell women to trust your gut, trust your instinct. You're usually right. And don't be so polite. Like, if you're getting a bad feeling, even if it's like a coffee date and you're at Starbucks or your local coffee house, if you're just getting a real creepy feeling from that person, find an excuse to get out. It just makes sense. Women are so polite, and they don't want to rock the boat or seem like they're being rude. And you got to follow your instincts. And, you know, and I don't want to make this sound like online dating's so scary, because, you know, it's been a really good way for me to meet people out of my social circle maybe we haven't had the romantic connection, but we've remained friends and actually good friends. And actually, one of the guys I dated, he wrote a little section in my book to give tips to women how to better represent themselves in the profile. And it works out okay. And a lot of your listeners are coming through the whole holiday slump. You know, we had Thanksgiving, and then you went to the family dinner and stuff by yourself. And then we had Christmas and all those Christmas parties and company parties you went to alone, you know, and then you go into let's not forget New Year's, you know, where you want the kiss at midnight, and now we're hitting the big one, which is, of course, Valentine's Day. And, you know, this is a time where you can actually get really good deals online, and because they know that people are kind of thinking about relationships more, and so they have a lot of deals. And so, you know, it can be, you know, if you're looking for love, I think now this is a real valid way to go about finding it, and I talk a lot about that in Cyberwink.
Yeah, no question about it, because when you really come down to it, I have to go back to what we originally said, that it is a way to meet people that normally people wouldn't have. It's like, you know, for yourself, if you didn't have this, where would you go? Truthfully, where would you go? How many people do you know who know somebody who knows somebody, when it really comes down to it? And if you are not, again, living in a major city, this also presents a problem.
It does, and I got some stats off the internet that were kind of interesting for 2010, so I'm sure they've gone up in the last year, but the 1 in 5 singles who are currently in a committed relationship with someone, they met them on a dating site, and that in the last, you know, back in 2010, in that year, 17% of couples who married met on a dating site. So this is, you know, people say, oh my goodness, you have to go online, you must be a loser, but one of the reasons I wrote Cyberwink was because I saw so many, and men and women, who are intelligent, who are attractive, who have traveled, who, you know, have so much going for them, but they're just not willing to settle, and they want to meet someone that they're really, you know, that they really see as a potential partner. And actually, my friend Mike, he had gotten divorced. He was 47 years old, and he really wanted, he's not a dater, he wanted a relationship. And I went through his Match.com profile, and we rewrote some things, and we took some new pictures, and a girl wrote to him, and they corresponded, and then they met. And they actually have been together now for 6 months, and she lived two streets away from him.
Wow.
And they probably walked around the same grocery store, but they would never have met. And so I would tell people, you know, give it a chance. You need to be safe about it, just like you were saying. But, it, you know, it's actually a really, it can be a really great way to meet new people.
Okay, now, but when you're a teacher, when you're walking down the hallway with the seventh graders, do they nudge each other and look at you and wink, giggle?
You know what? It's funny because I had kind of kept this book a secret. I'm writing a couple of other books right now as well that are unrelated to this topic. And they know, like it was announced when my book was first published this fall, oh, you know, Miss Risling is a published author, and they were all clapping and whistling, you know, and they were all excited. But I showed them the book, but I kind of covered the title, and they'd ask me what it was about, and I just say, well, it's not really for kids, and there's nothing that, like, if they read it, there's nothing in there that they would look at and think, oh, Miss Risling, whoa, you know, it's a very clean book, you know, but because they're my students right now, they're on a need-to-know basis, and my dating life, they don't need to know, you know?
Absolutely, so. And teachers are people, too.
Yeah, and, you know, and but they're excited, and, you know, since they found out I'd published a book, I have several of my 12-year-olds that are writing novels as we speak about zombies and, you know, aliens and different things,
wait,
and so for me, that's, you know, a good thing.
You know, it's interesting what, you know, culturally, what's in their mind. There you are writing about dating and an innocent thing, and the kids are writing about zombies. That's good.
It's great, right?
Oh, I know.
Yeah, and so it's, you know, and I would just tell people, if you go onto my website, and my website is Cyberwink, and that's all together, C-Y-B-E-R, and then W-I-N-K.net. If you go onto the website, there's a free quiz that you can take. And it tells you whether you're kind of cut out to cut out for online dating. And it's kind of funny, but there's a lot of truth in it. And you can go on, and it tells you what to do if maybe you go on a date and you liked the guy, but they didn't like you, or maybe they like you, but you didn't like the guy. And it's just kind of, you know, it brings up some of the issues, but it's really funny. And so people might enjoy taking that. And there's a spot, too, where they can write about their most disastrous dating experience and share it with, you know, people too on my website. So if they want to try that, they can go to cyberwink.net. And if they want to buy my book, there's a big button that says buy the book, and they can kind of check out. A lot of the stories are funny. Like, I met one guy, he brought his baby on the first date with him. That was crazy. You don't think that this stuff could really happen, but it does. And I also had someone propose to me on the first date. And
first date.
I mean, you pretty much name it, Michael, and I think it's happened to me.
Been there, done. Karen, we're starting to run out
of
time. One more time,
okay.
Please. Slowly with your website.
Sorry?
Your website. Just say it slowly.
Oh, my website. Okay, I couldn't hear him. Sorry, your voice was real quiet there. My website is Cyberwink, and that's all one word, CYBERWINK.net. And, I'd love to hear from anybody. I've got a blog, and if they want to subscribe, it's for free. And I promise you won't be inundated with them. They'll just be probably about once every week or 2 weeks. And you can read book excerpts and see if you like the stories. But I would just love to hear from any of your audience.
Wonderful. Hey, Karen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate you having me on tonight. Have a good night.
You too. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you look on for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. We'll be right back.
all I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'd be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Gary Grossman with us, the author of Executive Actions and the sequel, Executive Treason. He's a print and television journalist, an Emmy Award-winning network television producer, and a film and a TV historian. His career has included stints on NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, yes, and more than 36 cable networks. Gary, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with executive decision, executive treason, what is that certain something that the public today has when it comes to whatever administration it is? And there's the conspiracy theory, and everybody's got some kind of an agenda. And it's almost like a soap opera anymore, the reality and or the movies.
Oh, you have nailed it. It's I'm actually calling the novels political reality thrillers. It seems that the primaries this year and the debates are cut from the same mold that reality shows are done. We're seeing incivility come to reach a new high. And to answer your question really in one word, it's noise. There's just so much noise. Everyone seems to have their own facts. Didn't used to be the case in debates. You did your best to get the right word out, but now there's just so much noise. And that comes a lot, as we know, from the news channels and from talk radio, and that's really what I drill down in, particularly in Executive Treason.
No, absolutely. When we deal with talk radio, and for years and years, Gary Abernathy is, 29 years now. And, you know, in 1983 is when I started, way back when we didn't have faders, we had knobs, okay?
And I knew those.
and when it really came down to it, the power that the talk show host has over that audience that that host garners, Rush Limbaugh, you know, I mean, the list goes on, good, bad, or indifferent. They listen because it's quote-unquote gospel, and what the host says is what the audience believes, for the most part, and that can even cause a drastic difference in public opinion for voting for somebody or not voting for somebody.
Well, it sure does, and that's what I really tried to put to fiction, which seems all too real in Executive Treason, with a talk show host who is broadcasting from the geographic center of the 48 contiguous states. If you draw a line from Washington State down to Florida and another one from the tip of Maine down to Southern California and San Diego, you in those crosshairs, there's Lebanon, Kansas, which is the geographic center of the U.S. And that's where a character I have named Elliot Strong, S-T-R-O-N-G, Elliot Strong has a program called Strong Nation. And he has the power and the influence times 100 that many of the top talk show hosts have now. And like many of the talk shows, he doesn't have guests because they would challenge him. He just puts out his own opinion and has people of like mind calling in. And he amasses incredible power. And the ultimate question is, why? What is he doing? What is the end game for him? And ultimately, it is a change in the administration in the United States, which actually I took a page from our own American history from the 1930s when there was an actual coup attempt to bring down Franklin Roosevelt by Wall Street industrialists. And at the 11th hour, the man who these folks on Wall Street wanted to insert into the White House and get Franklin Roosevelt out, he was a World War I general named Smedley Butler. Great name. You can't make that up.
Marine Corps Smedley Butler.
Yes, absolutely. A great Marine general. Well, he was more of a patriot than a scoundrel at the 11th hour, and he did not go forward with what would have been a coup. Well, in executive treason, there's a general much like him, much like Smedley Butler, General Robert Woodley Bridgeman, who's being used by this talk show host, Elliot Strong. And his goal is to get the White House the same way. And we, you know, have to ask, is something like that so far-fetched? No, because talk show hosts have so much power, and that's really what I grab onto in executive treason, which springs from executive actions. And that book deals directly with something that we all read about last year, sleeper cell spies, Russian sleeper spies operating in the United States.
Now, by the way, what you're saying, I think, is absolutely spot on, because years ago I learned a very valuable lesson. I was standing in an office. I had another business at the time. And I was standing in the office, and I was listening to a couple of women talking about a soap opera. You would have thought that these people were real in the soap opera. I mean, they were into it. It was almost like they were gossiping about their neighbors. So when a talk show host garners a particular audience, the audience starts to get on board because they feel accepted. They're having the same line of thinking, and they actually create their own identity out of it. So in and of itself, it becomes a subculture of the culture, and then it's moved in the direction that, if the host knows what he or she's doing, in the direction that the host wants him. Because now, all of a sudden, they're part of what goes on in that show.
Oh, completely. It's as if they've joined the club, or they've sipped the Kool-Aid, and what they accept as gospel can be as made up as we hear it every day. Suddenly, you're saying black is white and white is black. That, and if you say that loud enough, or go means stop and stop means go, and I'm giving very general examples. There are, in fact, very coded racial messages today and very coded political messages today. And it comes down to one of my favorite quotes, Michael, and it's 100 years old. Mark Twain said, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting its boots on.
Yeah.
And isn't that true about talk radio?
No, absolutely. Because I remember something said about two or three weeks ago. Can't remember who it was that said it, but they were so serious when they did. It doesn't matter whether you're Democrat, Republican, whatever, just the comment. The comment was, Republicans, they love guns and they hate women. Now, if there's enough people who start to believe something like that, now you've got a thought that's spinning out of control out there, and they tie into it. It's like, let's say, one of the candidates, they want a control over immigration coming in, illegals coming into the country. But you can translate that into racism. So it's whatever they want to say about it, If you tie into that belief system, all of a sudden you got people on board, and it's exactly what you're talking about. The control is there.
And it's so powerful today. It's so viral today. Again, that lie can travel around the world so quickly. Well, in a viral environment, which we live in, somebody says it, and then it's echoed, and it's picked up, and it's emailed, and it's blogged. And in fact, in terms of a lot of bloggers, you know, people are putting things out as evidence and as truth when it really doesn't stand to be there.
Sure.
And yet, at the same time, for authors today, we have to use that. We have to use the viral means to get words out, as well as certainly radio and television, word of our books, and not such a subtle turn. Even these books are e-books, and
yeah.
You're kind of. I used to have a picture in front of me from the Grand Central Railroad train coming towards me. I think it was the Grand Central Limited. It's a kind of an old famous poster. This was a recreation of it. And that train is really coming right towards me. And I've always thought you're either on the train or you're under it. And now every means that we have to communicate through the Internet, whether it's books or conversation like this or reaching out to people, so much of our time is spent through the web, through the Internet, quickly. I remember hearing years ago that we would have more leisure time by now, you know, the four-day work week. Well, if anything, it's the 20-hour workday times seven, it seems. And yet, in the hands of somebody who presumably has all the answers, like Elliot Strong in Executive Treason, when you are looking for a better life or a better leader or a way out, you start beginning to want to believe these demagogues.
Absolutely. There was a great example of that on, it must have been about 3 or 4 months ago. There was an African-American woman in New York standing on her deck naked, and she wouldn't leave, and the cops were trying to get her off, and she was saying, the president promised this, promised that, said he's going to pay for my rent, this, this, and that, and none of it's going on, and she's going to stand there until it happens. Well, obviously, they got her off. But the point of contention is if we offer somebody something, and if it's good enough, they start to follow. And it's all of a sudden, or better yet, we are in a rewards-based society. You're a kid, and your mom says, clean up your room, take it to the show, do this, we'll give you candy. Well, we're the same in this culture also. If you promise me something, I vote for you. And what would happen if you got into that kind of a situation and there was terrorism behind it?
Well, that you've now really cut to the quick on executive actions and executive treason. And as we saw even just a year ago, and it's not a new thing. It's certainly been around since the 50s and 60s, kind of surprising that it was right in our midst this past year. Russian spies, sleeper spies, waiting to be awoken or quietly collecting information or infiltrating into the system. Not so much necessarily these days having to pose and fake their way as Americans, because we live in a world where you hear a country where you hear accents everywhere now.
Sure.
In the 50s and 60s, that would have been more suspicious. Today, walk down the street, and it's certainly a multicultural country. But do we really know if everybody here is here for the reasons they say they are? And we discovered with 10 Russian spies last year deported, they weren't here for the reasons they said they were. And I even take that a step further, are some of the political candidates, and this is in executive actions, the people
sure.
who we really think we are. Well, we heard that in the news, certainly, at least accusations of that, with President Obama time and time again, and people saying a lie over and over and over, where so many, I don't know, it's fair to say hundreds of thousands of people, if not more, believe it to be true. And
sure.
and again, it goes back to that power that the people have. I'm not really launching an attack on the media, but it's more on the demagoguery in the media,
yeah.
the power that some of these people have. So I raise that issue in executive actions, and then I take it further in executive treason and put it really through the mouths, or the mouth in particular, of Elliot Strong. By the way, you can actually hear Elliot Strong. I decided, again, getting back to using the media, I decided to create a website where you can actually hear and experience Elliot Strong as if he's on the radio from the book. So you can go to GaryGrossman.com. You'll get a whole picture of the book and appearances and things, including this, but you can also drill down into Elliot Strong, because I have a website called strongnationradio.com. It's made up. It's made up.
No, 1938, Orson
very
Welles.
Very real.
Wait, 1938,
pardon?
Orson Welles. 1938, Orson Welles, The War of the Worlds.
Yes, War of the Worlds.
Got it loud and clear. By the way, I think one of the problems we have, and Gary, we're starting to run out of time, but the news in and of itself, there is a blur between news and entertainment, and sometimes we can't decide which is which.
Oh, completely true. And, you know, it is the business of news, as it is the business of show business. And, you know, hearkening back to something we talked about earlier, there used to be one set of facts, and now it seems there's a multiplicity of facts. So people
facts?
Turn
what are
to
those?
A news channel that they'll agree with.
That's the whole point. But facts, what are those? Well, you don't want to trip on them because they may get in your way of whatever you're trying to accomplish. It is very scary out there. I think you should be all over the place with this, because if somebody will listen, even if you put it, you know, in a third person with the books, look at what's going on today. People are so immersed in all of these different messages that they want to close their ears. I've heard a couple of people say, I won't listen to the news anymore. That's scary, because if you don't listen, you don't know what's going to happen to you. We have a situation now where whatever is behind it, the country that we were brought up in, the culture that we were brought up in, is almost no more. And we don't even look like we used to look. And if we're not very careful, we're not going to be what we were, quote unquote. So everything that you're talking about and everything in the book seems to be going on in its own way today. If you want to destroy this country, toe-to-toe, you can't stand up to us. It's not going to happen. But if you do want to destroy the country, you make it implode. You go from the inside. You divide.
Right.
What I'm seeing right now is a division between black and white, male and female, class. I mean, it just this list goes on.
It's gotten scary, and I think as novelists, one of the most exciting things for me to do is to try to think the unthinkable. At the same time, there are some things I will not write about because I don't want them to be imitated. But to think the unthinkable brings you closer to really what's possible, what reality is, which is why I'm not even just calling them international thrillers or political thrillers. I'm calling executive actions and executive treason political reality thrillers, because the reality is there. The reality jumps from the headlines, or in many cases, it'll be, which scares me even more, tomorrow's headlines.
Absolutely. And what I see in transitions, you take our military today, that I, for the life of me, cannot believe that anybody would have to be economically challenged once they've got out of the service, if they have been hurt in any way, shape, or form, that somebody could go homeless, somebody could, I mean, this list goes on. I don't know how we can do that to those kids that have gone out and they've put their life on the line for us and come back and somebody's going to call them a babysitter. And, you know, people stand at cemeteries and scream and yell, you know, that they should die and so on and so forth. Something's wrong here, and somebody's got to be strong enough to stand up and say, this is America. Love it or leave it. I mean, quote, unquote.
Michael, I felt probably for the last, probably at least 3-4 elections maybe, too often we have a president who's the president of the Republican Party during those terms, and then we have a president who's the president of the Democratic Party. We're missing presidents of the United States.
Yes.
And in our lifetime, we've had them, but it is so divisive, and it's so hard to tell the difference between a reality show with people slinging four-letter words and bleeping everything. Hard to distinguish, separate that from even town hall meetings these days, and even the halls of Congress. That incivility is everywhere, but that's what people like Elliot Strong feed on in Executive Treason. It's what other people in real life feed on and make a lot of money doing it. And I simply ask, is there a reason other than money? Is there some fulfillment that they want to do that goes as far as the White House?
I hate to say it, no. You know, and I think I've got the fix for the whole thing. Go ahead and ask me who I would like to see as president of the United States. Go ahead, ask me.
Hey, Michael, I'm very impressed that you knew that General Smedley Butler was a Marine. So I'm going to ask you now, who would you like to see as president of the United States?
John Wayne. Who else? And the Fonz is vice president. The problems would be over. Okay.
A good call. Don't think we can make that happen, though.
Oh, we could try. Gary, can we get your website where we can get the books and
sure.
More?
Thank you very much, Michael. It's GaryGrossman.com, G-A-R-Y, Grossman, G-R-O-S-S-M-A-N. So www, if you still need to put that in, GaryGrossman.com. It'll take you to the buying portals for the e-books, and also you can experience Elliot Strong. And with your permission, I'd love to be able to have a link to this interview.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
Terrific.
No question.
Thank you.
Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. The message underneath the books, I think, are wonderful. So go get them.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye now. Thank you.
Lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. We're fighting with a cat. The cat is winning. The cat is going to get the microphone. Brad Taylor back with us. He's the author of All Necessary Force Beyond Special Forces Lies, Our Last Line of Defense. Gary's been over 29 years, 21 years as a U.S. Army in the U.S. Army, retiring as a Special Force Lieutenant Colonel. And during that time, he held numerous infantry and special operations positions, including 8 years in the 1st Special Forces Operation Detachment Delta, where he commanded multiple troops and a squadron. And let us say, Brad Hyde, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. It's a little bit of a battle getting through. Speaking of battle, I got a cat here who jumped on the desk and demanded the microphone, and he's bigger than I am. So, you know how that goes.
I've got a different animal of a dog, so I understand.
Oh, I got it. What was your impetus behind the second book? Because when we really look at it, there's a tremendous amount of confusion that we have today. And a lot of that confusion is not that we don't, it's not what we don't know. It's what we don't know, and there are so many things going on behind the scenes that are very dangerous unless we can take a look at them.
Yeah, what I did in the second book is I just took a step back and I looked at the critical infrastructure of the United States, and I said, you know, if I was a terrorist, what would I hit? Would I hit the ports? Would I hit the railroads? Would I hit hospitals, schools? What would it be, financial institutions? And I picked a system that I'd hit to take out to do a lot of economic and actual material damage. And in Special Forces, we have this thing called a Carver Matrix, which basically analyzes systems to see what components you'd remove. And it didn't take me very long just using open source internet to figure out what I would remove from that system to cause catastrophic failure. And the story is basically that.
Now, by the way, if someone were to pick the book up, and they, if they had the possibility to go step by step, could they do the same thing that's in the book?
Not exactly along the lines that are in the book. I, for instance, there's a nuclear plant in there, and they attack a nuclear plant a certain way. All of that is realistic. The plant is real, but the distances involved are not real. You couldn't attack the plant the way I said. You'd get rolled up pretty easily.
Good. but I really believe what we don't see is, like, you take yourself with all the experience that you have, you see things beyond what the normal person sees. Quote, unquote, you see the invisible. You see what's there. And if you had the wherewithal, if you had the ability to become the, quote, unquote, king of the defense in America, what do you think you would do? How do you think you would handle it as opposed to the way that it's being handled now?
Well, the problem we have, it's a quid pro quo. It's a, there's a trade-off. We are an open society. We are a democracy, and we're also very vast. The only way you could really protect all of our critical infrastructure is if we had a totalitarian state. That's not to say we do a real good job at it. America usually, unfortunately, reacts after an incident. You know, the World Trade Center's drop on 9/11, we create the TSA. All these vulnerability assessments where I got all my information from, they're all on the web. It's not like I'm telling anybody what they need to hear. They're the ones that told me.
Yeah, Brad, I wasn't there with that. What I really meant was that everything is so out in the open anymore. Everything is so visible, quote unquote, that almost anybody can get into anything that we have, do whatever they're going to do. And you just said it. We always react afterwards. We don't take that first step to really make sure that it's not being done. So that's really what I meant by that. Not necessarily the book was a step by step how to hurt us. That's not what I meant. But the point of contention,
right,
here.
But I mean, the truth of the matter is, in the leadership of the country, even if they wanted to do this, the American population just has no memory. They just start screaming and yelling. I mean, they scream and yell about TSA all the time. I don't want to go through the security. It's not fair. Well, okay. Well, we'll have another plane crash into another tower then.
Yeah, and I think really what it comes down to, we are our own worst enemy when it comes to a lot of these things. Because we yell about, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of this, freedom of that. And at the same time, if we're not careful, we're not going to have any of those freedoms.
Right.
Okay, now, when you got to the book, when you the impetus to write it this way, as you got deeper and deeper into it, did you find things that you weren't aware of yourself? Did your eyes get open even more than they were when you first started this?
No, not as far as if you're talking about vulnerability of the systems we have. We used to study that when I was in the military and Special Forces. We studied it quite a bit anyway. So I had a healthy appreciation of where we were strong, where we were weak to begin with.
Okay, so but as you got into the book, using that as a base, no question about it, there's usually a place where fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, doesn't really matter what it is, where when you put something to pen, as you start to get into it, you start to see things that you didn't think about, even before you started to write the book. Where were those places for you?
Well, at the tactical level, there's certainly a lot of places where I had to solve a certain problem, and I went and did reconnaissance on it. For instance, the terrorists obtained some ammunition from Fort A.P. Hill, actually explosives from Fort A.P. Hill, and I went there and studied and figured out how it hit that site. And after I was done, that was another part of the book I couldn't put in the book. I was like, you've just written a blueprint on how to hit this place. It'd be fairly easy to do with my background and with my ability to do the reconnaissance. So I went back and rewrote it and threw in some more red herrings to make sure I wasn't giving a blueprint of how to get on Fort A.P. Hill and steal explosives.
Yeah, isn't that kind of interesting? You've got a book and you're going to go deep. You want to keep the audience, you know, just tied right to it. And at the same time, you got to protect us because of everything you do know. It's kind of an interesting place you had to be in.
Yeah, it is. It's actually one of the harder things I do because I do know classified technology. I do know classified TT or tactics, techniques, and procedures. And I'm not putting that in the book because I'm certainly not going to give the enemy an edge, and I'm certainly not going to put any of my friends who were still in the arena in harm's way. So luckily it's fiction, though, so I can always back up and say, I can't use this, write it a different way. So it's still just as accurate and just as realistic. I just stay away from giving away anything.
Yeah, Brent, okay, I picked the book up, All Necessary Force. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I get that I didn't have before I read the book?
Well, I'll be honest with you. Right off the bat, what I hope you got was a lot of sleepless nights. What I really want is just someone to enjoy the book. But at the end of the day, I want to show a moral component for the, you know, for war on terrorism, or, you know, just all of that stuff. That special forces operator too often is, you know, some lone wolf who, if he could torture everybody, he'd solve all the problems, and he'd wake up the next morning, you know, like a spring daisy. When, in fact, an operator makes life and death decisions with national repercussions, and he lives with those decisions. And by the same token, the terrorist himself is not, you know, Dr. Evil. He's a human being, and he has his own decisions to make. And I tried to show that through the book.
Now, by the way, today, in defense of the country, are our hands tied? It seems as though every time we do something, we have to either apologize to someone or somebody's going to go to prison for doing the job that they're supposed to do. You know, and it's changed in the last 10, 15 years. Whatever political correctness is, the PC, that it's spread all over this country and it moved forward. And it seems as though our military, the CIA, the FBI, all of those agencies, they're pretty much hamstrung. You can't do what you could do at one time.
I don't really see that. Maybe internally with you know, the Patriot Act and things like that, with our own civil liberties, there's a lot of hue and cry going up. But, I mean, just a few months ago, we killed an American citizen in Yemen with a Predator drone strike. That would have never have happened 10, 15 years ago. So I don't really see us being hamstrung taking the fight to the enemy.
Okay, well, all right, but with taking the fight to the enemy, I think we have to really define who and what the enemy is anymore. If you pull somebody over and they're suspicious of doing something, you better know exactly what you're doing or you're going to end up in trouble yourself. I think that's what it is. There's so much protection and quote-unquote sensitivity about stopping somebody, about addressing the problem, about interrogation, that's where I'm thinking that everybody's got to be hamstrung at this point.
Yeah, I would say I've seen that internally. Because we had, right after 9/11, you had a lot of activities that went on that now, you know, years later, people are looking back on and saying, hey, we're losing our own civil liberties. Let's back this up. I just saw a lawsuit. They're using Predator drones down on the border with Mexico. They aren't armed. All they're doing is doing reconnaissance to catch illegal immigrants coming across the border. Somebody's now suing to get the tapes from those because they think it's an infringement on their civil rights because it flew over somebody's farm. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous.
Well, that's one example, but that's so much of what we're being faced with today. And if you take somebody that's actually out on the front lines, quote unquote, that's what I mean when I say that they're hamstrung. You've got to be very careful because if we, quote unquote, step on somebody's civil rights, even if they're not an American citizen, there's major problems, you know, lawsuits and so on and so forth that go on that didn't go on 10, 15 years ago. Now, when we take a look at
In All Necessary Force, that's kind of a big theme because the task force itself is an illegal organization that operates outside the bounds of U.S. law, and its mandate is by the charter they created it with, it would never, ever operate on U.S. soil because it didn't want to turn into a Gestapo force. And in the book itself, the terrorist threat ends up on U.S. soil, and the only one who's got a thread to stopping it is the task force. and they have to make that very same decision, a moral dilemma. Do I let these guys operate in America, or do I let the terrorists, you know, see if I can catch them some other way?
Now, by the way, when we talk terrorists, obviously bin Laden's gone, no question about it. And they're, you know, the administration's screaming and yelling that the world's a better place. Well, how powerful was he towards the end? I mean, was he the be-all, end-all, or are there so many others that are just like him that we don't even know about that have been operating for years?
Well, bin Laden, it's a long-term question, kind of a dual-pronged thing. As far as his operational capacity to do damage to us controlling al-Qaeda, that was not that great. We did disrupt some attacks from killing him. But his big calling card was his recruitment capability. People flocked to bin Laden because he was a David, taking it to the Goliath, to the great Satan. We never could get him. He'd done the strikes on 9/11. Plenty of terrorist groups. There's al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb. They used to be called the GSPC. There's al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They were a different terrorist group. Everybody took the mantle of al-Qaeda because it was such a good, this is a guy that's doing the success, want to be associated with him. Removing him removed an enormous amount of recruiting capacity for that organization, and that's the long-term effect of that most people don't discuss. I mean, if you go in the Middle East, you can go to bazaars, it used to be anyway, you go to bazaars and people are selling pictures of him, they were hanging on the walls, everybody loved that guy. Well, we popped that bubble of his invincibility, he's gone. And that, coupled with the Arab Spring, because al-Qaeda's primary doctrine was, we want to get rid of all the infidel governments in the Middle East, but the near enemy, they call them. But in order to do that, we have to bring down the far enemy, which is the West, the United States, at the top of the list. And so he was saying, we've got to go attack the far enemy. Well, the Arab Spring proved that, no, actually, you don't have to attack the far enemy. We can take down the near enemy all by ourselves. So that dual-pronged approach has pretty much destroyed his recruiting capacity. And it was a pretty good thing.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. There's a little bit of a delay, but go ahead and finish your statement.
I was saying it was a dual-pronged approach with the Arab Spring coupled with his death has definitely hampered his recruiting capability.
You know, it seemed interesting, you know, with all the experience you had, the 20-some-odd years, you know, in the service, being an officer, once you've got that much into it, it never stops, does it? You're always going to be, that's always going to be within you. It would have to be hard just to get into something else once it's all over with. So once you've got that incorporated into your heart and soul, my goodness, you're always going to be that, which I think is a great thing.
Well, yeah, I make most of my money. I still do security consulting work. That's really where I make my living at. So I'm still kind of in the arena as it is.
I hear you. Okay, we're just about out of time. Brad, website we can find you at, buy the book, and get some more information.
Sure. It's at bradtaylorbooks.com. They can read an excerpt of both One Rough Man and Unnecessary Force. And I actually have a blog on there that's got a lot of the questions you've been talking about, national security issues.
Wonderful. Hey, Brad, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
You feel good night.
So lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you gon' get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you for you.
can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Helena Robinos with us is a background in statistics and technology, now runs a successful feng shui consulting business, and for nearly a decade now, she's helped people from all walks of life, including celebrity students, married couples, and single women wanting a relationship. Her book is He's Into You, But Is His Home? It's the first in a series called Walls Do Talk. Helen, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Feng Shui, when we look at that, where did that start from? How was that created, and what's the impetus behind it?
Feng Shui's origination is in China thousands of years ago. It started about 5,000 years ago, and it was limited to just the ruling class because it was believed to be so powerful. So the rulers would not allow the Feng Shui masters to practice their skill with anybody but the ruling class so that they could remain in power. And it has evolved through the years, and it's gone underground because it's been outlawed in China many years ago. And it's come back, and it's making a comeback here in the United States. It was made popular or brought into popularity in the 1980s when some masters from China came here, and they kind of modified feng shui to make it more understandable to Westerners so that they could really grasp the concept of energy and how energy around us, including in our home, can impact our lives. It's a sister modality to acupuncture and is based in some of the same ancient practices and uses the same five elements found in nature as the premise and the foundation for creating balance and harmony.
So we're talking about then energy flow and just, yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. It's about energy flow around us and how we're impacted by that.
No, I just changed my living room about 3 weeks ago. I was looking at it, and I had the couch, and I had the two love seats, and it was squared off and kind of blocked the doorway and so on and so forth. And I read something about changing that and opening it up. And I moved some things around. The place looks three times bigger, but that would be something like feng shui would say to do.
Absolutely. It sometimes is about color and certain elements, like I talked about in nature, wood, fire, earth, metal, or water to balance energy, but oftentimes it is about placement. People sometimes place furniture in a way that blocks or restricts energy flow, and then it also creates other issues. One common term we use in feng shui is called a power position, and a position of power is one where your back is protected, so for example, a wall behind you. And there's some protection on the sides. So think of a chair, like an armchair. You have a back to the chair and sides, and it's open to the front. And the premise goes back thousands of years to imagine the ancient tribes warring. You wanted to make sure your back was protected by a mountain, and maybe there were trees or small hills on the side of you, and your enemy could only approach from the front, making sure that you aren't surprised, no surprise attacks. So creating kind of that same feel in your home of a power position so you can see the door and your back is protected tends to cause people to be more relaxed, and it usually will open up a room and how it looks and how it feels as well.
When you say open up a room, one of the things in your press release I think is interesting, the bedroom, anything that does not enhance your bedroom's only two purposes, sleep and romance, should be removed. The television, everything out of there, but that isn't necessary to that room. Does that mean dressers and nightstands? And that's a question, I don't know. I'm asking.
No, dressers and nightstands are fine as long as they are kept neat and appealing. If you leave your drawers open with clothes tumbling out of them or pile books on your nightstand, then that is all active energy, creating a less peaceful environment for you to sleep in. So as quiet as you can keep the environment, that includes covering mirrored wardrobe doors that were so popular many years ago and many people still have. If you hang a drape or a curtain in front of that, it'll quiet it down and most people will get more restful sleep. As far as the other items in there, I always say that, you know, when we were children, we all had a bedroom and that was our everything room. We slept there. We did our homework. We entertained our friends there. We played games there. Everything we did was in our bedroom. And sometimes we forget that when we grow up and have the whole house, that we don't need to do that anymore. And the bedroom is the bedroom. It's for sleeping and romance. And all of those other things, whether you keep your desk in your bedroom,
sure,
or bookshelves or your sporting equipment, large televisions, all of those things tend to activate the room and distract you. So it can disrupt sleep and it can also distract you from the other person in the room that's with you.
Oh, no, there's something I hadn't thought about before. Reducing friction and territorial feelings over closet space. I wonder how many people actually think of something like that, and yet there is that friction. There is that problem every once in a while of, you know, who's got the most space and who's going to go where and so on and so forth. So how do you do that? How do you balance that out?
That's an interesting subject, Michael. In almost every lecture that I give, I get argument, usually from the women, because women tend to take up the closet space and they often ban their husband or boyfriend to a guest closet or a hall closet with their things. And I always tell them, what message do you want to send? Do you want to let the man in your life know that you want him near or that you want your clothes near? And it's a difficult subject because I don't know why, but women in this culture in particular tend to have a lot of clothes and they want them all nearby. We want the choices when we're getting dressed. We want to be able to choose from that large array of clothing. And yet I say it diminishes an opportunity for intimacy. If your husband has to go down the hall to get dressed rather than staying there next to you and you can get dressed together, it takes away from an opportunity to have intimacy together. So I recommend to people, don't fight over it, but try to put your clothes in the same closet, at least some of them, the things that you use day to day most frequently. Put them in the closet where you both can access them in the bedroom there together. Now, there are exceptions, as in everything, that, you know, if one of you wakes up at 4 a.m. to get to work and one doesn't get home from work till midnight, you might not want to disrupt each other. So there are exceptions that feng shui, applying feng shui, is a balance as well. You want to make sure that you balance the recommendations of feng shui with your lifestyle, so that you don't create more challenges in your life by applying feng shui. So there are exceptions to every rule, but whenever possible, put those clothes together. It'll, as you're then able to share that intimate time while you're dressing.
Now, by the way, your background is in statistics, technology, and feng shui has to be something completely different. Where did you, and I'm not to say fall into this, where did this happen for you? What was that moment that you went, oh, there's something different here?
Well, I think as a child, I was just very sensitive to my environment. So I was always feeling like something needed to be different. I would draw floor plans of my parents' home and cut out shapes of furniture and say, no, the dresser should be here. The sofa should be here. It needs blue here or red here. And I was sensing something. I didn't know what it was. But in the mid-80s, I was introduced to a man who was a native of China, and he mentioned feng shui, and I had no idea what it was. And as he started talking about it, bringing harmony and peace and just soothing the energy and can bring in prosperity and better relationships and better health and all of these wonderful benefits, I just started researching and looking for information. And back in the 80s, it wasn't that easy to find books and information, but I found what I could. And so in the 2005, I was ready to make a career change and decided this is what I want to do. And interestingly enough, statistics is not that far from feng shui, because statistics is all about gathering information, gathering data, analyzing it, interpreting it, and then making recommendations. And that's exactly what I do in every home that I go into for a consultation or every business. I gather the data about the home, the property. I analyze the data. I interpret it and make recommendations to the client about how to balance that energy. So it applies the same skill set that being a statistics major does, just analyzing different data.
Because you're talking vibration, frequency, the flow. So I imagine it would be actually the same thing if you knew how to deal with it. Now, how long did it take you to really grab on and say, to catch on to it?
Well, certain pieces of it came very quickly for me, almost intuitively. But as everything, like doctors continue with their education throughout their career, and they're constantly learning not only from the courses they take and the books they read, but also from the patients that they meet, because they learn different nuances or subtle little things that can be a trigger for a certain symptom, if you will. And the same thing for me. I've done a lot of formal training. There are people out there in feng shui, I've heard, that have read a book and claim that they are a feng shui professional, but I would caution the listeners about that. Make sure someone has some formal training if you're interested in getting a consultation. And that training continues on. I'm also a member of a group of practitioners. We have a group that we just exchange information, share, and support each other. So we're all learning from each other about different situations, or we pool that information if someone has a unique client they're working with and a challenge. We all work together and support each other, but it's a continuing education. I am learning just about every day. I'm still learning.
That's what life's about. Helen, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at and also find the book.
Sure. Thanks, Michael. ishishome.com will take you right to my website, the page of my book, and you can visit any other pages on the website as well.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here. And I really believe that when you come down to it, whatever the end result of the feng shui is, it works. And I've seen it work time and again. I can't explain it, but as long as it works, there's that old adage, don't fix what ain't broke.
Exactly, Michael. Thank you. And also, for anybody who visits my website, you can sign up to receive some free relationship secrets. You'll be sent one a week.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael. My pleasure.
Good night.
Good night.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. Dusty walls.